Amid all the talk of the potential for World War III, perhaps we need to realise that the world is already at war, only it's an information war. As the people of Ukraine understand all too well, the modern battlefield begins on keyboards, in television studios, and on social media, but can soon end up being fought with drones, missiles, and tanks. Truth and facts, therefore, need to be part of the armoury of every democratic government, leading to the obvious question, how do we win an information war? Surely we first have to recognise that such a war has already begun. I'm Gavin Essler, and this is Not a Drill. Back in 2014, Russia annexed part of Ukraine. Before the troops went in, the Kremlin prepared the ground for its land grab by sowing such doubt and confusion that Western countries seemed unable to mount a coherent response. Were those bits of Ukraine really Russian anyway? Did Moscow have a point? Since then, emboldened by success, Russia has continued to attempt to undermine Western unity, made its voice listened to in developing nations, and reinforced its front line on Ukrainian soil. While NATO's defences remain strong, public opinion in the West, particularly in the United States with the prospect of a second Trump presidency, is often less than enthusiastic about the idea of backing Ukraine's fight for survival with more and better weapons. So, are we already in an information war? And if so, what can we do about it? I've been speaking with the author and journalist Peter Pomerantsev. His first book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible, was an account of the changes in Russian society he experienced while working in Moscow at the beginning of Vladimir Putin's reign in the Kremlin in the early 2000s. This was followed by This is Not Propaganda, in which he dissected disinformation and post-truth politics and what he called a postmodern dictatorship. Now Peter's latest book is How to Win an Information War. And while it is in part a guide to countering Russian propaganda, its central character is a British World War II propaganda strategist who constructed radio broadcasts to weaken the Nazi grip on the German imagination. This unlikely genius strategist was a German-born popular newspaper writer, Tom Sefton Delmer. Peter, welcome. Your new book is called How to Win an Information War. Can we begin with that premise? Is there an information war right now? And if so, who are the combatants and where has it got to?
So, look, information war is actually a term that Russia uses in kind of both its doctrine and its rhetoric. I wrote about that a lot in my previous book, This is Not Propaganda. And it's a really tricky thing. So firstly, Russia defines all the sort of things that you once did, Gavin, sort of things like the BBC or human rights NGOs that criticize Russia. It says these are all part of an information war machine against Russia. They see information war, or what they call information psychological war, as an essential part of statecraft, and includes all kind of non-kinetic actions. So it's economics, digital. They actually sometimes put cyber in there, different doctrines. And the stuff that we would talk about, civil society, they'd say that's all information war. And therefore, they have the right to respond. I mean, it could well be that they want to respond first, and therefore they say everyone's doing it to them. You know, that's a bit of a circular story you can get into. But also in the Russian vision, it's sort of like a quasi-philosophy. It basically sort of says that, you know, there are no genuine, you know, marketplaces of ideas or democratic debates. Everything is manipulation. All information is manipulation. And it's a very cynical worldview where nothing is what it seems. No piece of invested journalism is a piece of invested journalism. It must have been ordered by some dark conspiratorial power to some end. So it's a sort of a worldview. So they use it to help explain the collapse of communism and loss in the Cold War. It's a revisionist history as well. So Russia, in this version, has become increasingly popular, lost the Cold War because of information war, not because of terrible policies and human rights abuses, but the West planted ideas like democracy as a tool to manipulate Russia. and undermine it. So that's how they define it. But really, like, no, we talk about it in Western countries as well, as I think a vision of information where it's used in a very, where it is used in quite, in, you know, a sort of like instrumentalized way to a certain political purpose.
I was struck actually when I knew I was going to talk to you, I had a look at InfoWars, the website in the United States, and it says of itself, very right-wing website, the number one independent news service in the world, we are apparently, battling globalism and promoting a pro-human future worldwide. InfoWars is tomorrow's news today, whereas Wikipedia says, InfoWars is an American far-right conspiracy theory and fake news website owned by Alex Jones. It was founded in 1999 and operates under Free Speech Systems, LLC. So, I mean, we kind of have it domestically as well, don't we? Or particularly in the United States. And that's the one of the most obvious examples.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's look, there's lots of patterns that we see across the world. It is interesting how both the Russians and someone like Alex Jones uses sort of like InfoWars as a sort of conspiratorial worldview, you know, to see the whole world as information warfare rather than genuine debate is, you know, puts you in a very, very, you know, there's already an interpretation going on there. But look, the term information war is also used sort of, you know, in a much more mainstream way to describe various types of, I don't know, strategic communications exercises. PSYOPs is used as well. Any type of competition where communication is being used in a very, very effects-driven way. Not just like, let's do the story and get it out there, but in a very, very sort of like pointed way.
Let's talk about Ukraine then, because obviously that's where Russia has been practicing some of the things that you've mentioned. Is there an information war going on there? And if so, who is winning and how is Ukraine doing?
So inside Ukraine as well, I mean, look, there's different ones. There's in the occupied territories where obviously Russia is using a very kind of updated, but a very Soviet version of propaganda to instill kind of mass obedience. So it's something I'm looking at now, actually, with the Reckoning Project, which is a war crimes NGO that I helped co-found at the start of the war, looking at how Russia imposes enforced re-education and indoctrination on populations. Very, very interesting how they do it. I mean, they first sort of isolate, you know, cut off, you know, a bit like a cult, cut off easy connections to any other type of media. Then they create an atmosphere of like vast fear, but also sort of rewards if you follow the rules. And then they start sort of re-educating people along an ideology of Russian supremacism, essentially, that, you know, Russia is a superior civilization and that Ukrainians have been are kind of grade two, lower level cousins of Russian civilization. They're part of one spirit, one sort of geist almost, and they've been forcibly removed by the West. And through punishment, but also systems of rewards, conditioning, making all positive experiences in Russian, negative ones in Ukrainian, they start to indoctrinate populations. I mean, the Chinese do something similar with the Uyghurs. So that's something that's going on inside the occupied territories. If we're talking about Ukraine itself, I mean, Ukraine has been a target of Russian operations, I mean, historically forever, but like really very actively since 2004, which was the sort of first Ukrainian protest movement in favor of free and fair elections. And the Russian candidate lost as a result. And since then, they've been using all types of things, including direct use of their own media to sow division and undermine confidence in Ukraine's reformers, including working through proxies, allied oligarchs, people who they control within the Ukrainian system, using the online piece as well, but not just the obvious stuff. You'd expect them to do pro-Russian websites saying, you're Russian and you belong to us. Much more cleverly, they would also invest in media that's actually very, very pro-Ukrainian, very pro-nationalist, but there they would seed stories how the West wants to steal Ukraine's grain, how the West is secretly controlling Ukrainian government. So it's not just the obvious propaganda, like be with us, you know, or else we'll kill you, but it's also undermining the option of westward developments. And that was very active, especially in the run-up to the invasion. And since then, obviously, a lot of that got shrunk. But it's starting to be active again within Ukraine. There's still a lot of loopholes they can get through in the sort of social media space, though TV channels have largely been censored, essentially, but I think with good justification.
You know, some of the bits that come out just seem ludicrous in this war. You know, the idea there were no Russian soldiers in Crimea back in 2014, or, you know, he's liberating Ukrainians from a terrible government, or, you know, the ridiculous claims about the mass murder of civilians in March 2022 in Bucha. And you said of that, I saw a quote saying, it's not disinformation. He's not trying to trick anyone. He's trying to say, I don't care. I'm going to lie, I'm going to murder, and there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, that is even, if anything, even more worrying.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's a bunch of things going on. There is, without a doubt, being able to lie and laugh in people's faces is a sign of power. Number two is, I mean, Russia is involved. I mean, sometimes these lies are very, very well thought through in terms of understanding our systems. So the there are no Russian soldiers in Crimea piece, it wasn't about belief, but the Russians knew perfectly well that that would slow down what's known as the OODA loop in NATO's reaction, which means the kind of like, you know, the analysis of what's going on in the decision making. Because if there was just enough implausible ambiguity, but it's still ambiguity, Russia's allies like Hungary or at that point Italy could go, well, we just don't know. I've got to have more proof. We've got to have more proof. So again, it's all about knowing the audience and giving the audience the excuse they need to do what they want. So propaganda isn't always, or actually often isn't, about persuasion. It is about legitimizing what people want to do. So with Bucha, I mean, there's different things. It could be that for some Russians, they want any excuse to say we didn't do it because they find it unpleasant. The other way around, I mean, a lot of the time, what they say is all Ukrainians are Nazis, which is, of course, a classic. I mean, it's a very funny thing when they say that. I mean, funny in a horrible way, but in the sense that they're using an old Nazi trick, but with the language of anti-Nazism, because what the Nazis used to do is basically say that, you know, Jews were non-Aryans and therefore you can do with them what you want. When Russia says these people are Nazis, what they mean is you can do with them what you want. So it's a way of dehumanizing huge parts of the Ukrainian population. As the Kremlin is saying it, we see these mass atrocities in Bucha, Yakhidne, all across the occupied territories. I'm not saying those were direct orders, but there's a correlation there between the switch in the rhetoric, smearing all of Ukrainians as Nazis, and this kind of rash of atrocities. So, you know, that's an old one that we should know from the 20th century. You dehumanize, delegitimize whole parts of the population so that you can then legitimize cruelty and sadism, which, again, horrible as it may sound, is something that certain people want.
How's Ukraine doing in the other side of this information war? Because certainly from the way in which most of the West has supported Ukraine, with the exception perhaps of some people in Washington, it seems to be doing quite well in saying we're not anything that Putin says. Putin is definitely the bad guy. The Russians are the invaders, and we actually stand up for Western democracy.
Yes, they were. I mean, that narrative is fairly solid, even in America. But there's many other arguments that the Russians are winning, and increasingly so, and especially in America. And America is the key country, to be honest. If American support goes, everything else is a little bit, for the moment, I don't want to say meaningless, but not as meaningful, to put it mildly. So the idea that there is no way for Ukraine to win, that this is a sunk whole cost, and so on and so on and so on. All that narrative is very, very, very strong. That Putin just wants to negotiate. All this sort of stuff is very, very strong and repeated by, you know, lots of influencers in the West and America. And again, it's because it's a narrative that people want to hear. You know, they want an argument that allows them to say Biden's wasting his money, Biden's a bad policymaker, we need a different kind of leader. So again, propaganda only works when it hits an audience that wants to hear it. And then beyond sort of Western Europe and America in the so-called Global South, which is a pretty awful term, but it sort of is used. No, they're the Russian narrative is popular. Their Russian media, state media and non-state media and proxies are very, very popular in the Middle East, in Latin America. There you see everybody from President Lula through to South Africa's leadership embracing Russian narratives consistently, again, because they marry nicely with their own ones about, you know, all this is really the West's fault and, you know, the ultimate evil is the West and Russia is our brother in the struggle against the hegemonic West. So no, I wouldn't limit our world to just that. Then there's China, which is supporting Russia in the propaganda sphere, and then there's Iran, which is now quite entwined with Russia in the propaganda sphere.
Yeah, that's a very complex pattern, and we're not helping ourselves very much by us, I mean the West, in the sense that, you know, we have our own problems. Donald Trump, according to the Washington Post, told at least 30,000 lies as president of the United States. Boris Johnson lied and lied continually about big and small things, you know, and there's a sense that all you have to do is say, do we actually know what we believe anymore from our own political leaders? And that presumably adds to the confusion about whether we should believe or disbelieve Putin.
Yeah, I think generally Putin has been a sort of a sobering moment because, you know, it's not just verbiage. I mean, there was like a blatant and brutal military invasion. You can do as much post-truth populism as you want, but then at the end of the day, when the big battalions start rolling into countries, it's pretty hard to avoid that reality. No, in America, it's less about whether Putin did it. It's like, why should we care? That's the argument in America. It's like, nobody kind of denies it, and even Trump will say it's a naughty thing to do. But the question is, should we care? And let's just do a deal with the devil. It's not our problem. So it's much more about that. It's much more about, you know, is it a waste of time and money to do anything about it? Why should we care about Ukraine? Is sort of the argument.
I suppose what I was trying to get at was the idea that, you know, what's the role of journalism here in a world in which, in the West in particular, people are looking at journalism and saying, oh, well, who pays them? They're all lying anyway. I mean, there is that streak, or my views are not represented. We hear that all the time in the United Kingdom now.
Yeah, I mean, and skepticism about the media is a sign of a healthy democracy, but then there's the sort of other extreme where you just don't believe anything. And where, again, there's studies that show this, that when people don't believe anything, they just end up believing conspiracy theories. So it's not as if, like, this sort of skepticism leads you to freedom. It leads you just to, like, info wars. It's a paradox. You have to be able to have the capacity to trust and verify to be able to actually think independently. It's a bit of a paradox, isn't it? You know, it's that radical, I don't believe anything at all, is actually takes people to places where they just embrace, or they can embrace, conspiratorial identities, really, because they're more than knowledge. They're about identities, about sort of like, I don't believe anyone. There's evil out there. I'm in my little bubble of the genuine here, and out there are the enemies. So that's where you can end up. Critical thinking is completely essential, but it sort of has to lead to something constructive where you can actually find a path to having faith in evidence.
So, Peter, let's turn to the main theme of your latest book, which is the story of Tom Sefton Delmer, a British journalist creating anti-Nazi propaganda in the Second World War. I've always thought there were two key figures in the propaganda area at this time. One is Adolf Hitler himself, who wrote about propaganda in Mein Kampf. The other is Edward Bernays, the American writing about propaganda in the 1920s. Yeah. But you focus on Sefton Delmer, whose name is perhaps less familiar to most of us. Can you explain a bit on who he was and why you focused on him and this amazing story you uncovered?
So Sefton Delmer is more, I find it bizarre that he's not better known, because he was really one of the heroes of Britain's information wars, communications battles in the Second World War. And he was very well known in his lifetime. There was an episode of This Is Your Life about him. Not only that, before the war, and this is his background, was in journalism. He was the sort of amazingly famous foreign correspondent. And I don't know who the equivalent would be today. I mean, maybe you, Gavin. But like, he was like a mixture of Tintin and Borat. He was the Daily Express's star reporter, going to every battle zone, you know, our man on the front lines. He was famous for having basically convinced the Nazis during the 1920s to allow him to follow Hitler in person on his famous propaganda flights around Germany. He really, why I say like Borat, he sort of pioneered this sort of journalism where he would sort of essentially dress up in various provocative social roles and see how people would react. So he dresses up in the 1920s as a sort of really awkward German tourist and goes around with a ridiculous accent, these kind of faulty towers like hotels on the south coast, and basically provokes people by being very obnoxious to seeing whether they're still Germanophobic, as in whether they've forgiven the Germans for the First World War. And then he disguises himself as Ernst Röhm, the head of the stormtroopers' assistant, and penetrates a stormtrooper rally. So an amazing guy, genius for impersonation, amazing storyteller, and as I say, very famous in his time. best known perhaps for his wartime work when he could write his memoirs, which was in the mid-60s. And basically during the war, he stopped being a journalist in the classic sense, and he basically ran Britain's covert propaganda into Germany and occupied territories. And what that meant in practice was creating and leading, essentially, I mean, it's hard to, we still don't know how many, but into the 24 or so radio stations that were broadcasting into Germany, the occupied territories. And it's an amazing operation based in Woburn Abbey. And it sort of had, I don't know, again, because part of the archive is still closed, but probably over 100 people working there, including Ian Fleming, who kind of helped create the whole thing. Muriel Spark, the novelist, did some work there. These incredible people who really try to understand the power of Nazi propaganda and how to undermine it. Then many stars from the cabaret scene in Germany. So basically what Delmer had, he had a lot of radio stations which cosplayed of being Nazis. German POWs, German emigres, and people from the cabaret scene, a lot of them Jewish, sort of pretending to be Nazis on the radio in order to undermine the Nazis by telling true stories about corruption among Nazi officials and demoralization in German ranks.
So why do you think we haven't heard his name so much in all those stories and mythologies about the war?
He wrote his memoirs, which were quite well known in the mid-60s. And then it's weird. We seem to have sort of pushed him out of public consciousness. An amazing archivist and historian, Lee Richards, has unearthed the political warfare executive. That's what the British government was called that looked after this. He's managed to get most of the archive. Couldn't have written this book without him. He's really sort of the real historian here. I'm, as we can tell from our conversation, not a historian. And Delmer's son thought that people didn't want to think about him too much because one could say that some of the stuff that he used was a bit of a dirty trick. You know, World War II was meant to be our finest hour. And people didn't want to think about the sort of the more underhand tactics that we used to subvert Nazi propaganda and to demoralize their troops. When I started going through his work, through the archive, through the memoirs, also through the transcripts of the radio shows, which we have, I kind of approached it that way as well. I was like, okay, what can I learn about today's disinformation from what we learned in the war, from what we did in the war? But very soon I realized there was something much more interesting going on. So from 1943, Delmer designed a lot of his media, certainly his most popular media, in such a way that Germans were meant to understand this was the British cosplaying Nazis. And what he was doing was giving people kind of a safe environment within which they could start to be disloyal to the Nazis. Safe in the sense of if you thought that the newspaper you were reading or the radio station you were listening to, even though you knew it was the British because of the content, but it had enough stuff there to make it feel German, you could always point to your officer when he busted you and say, I thought it was German, sir. I had no idea that this was the English. So they were giving physical cover because listening to foreign radio stations was a crime punishable by hanging in Germany, firstly. And secondly, here's where it gets really complicated and I think fascinating. He felt that it gave people psychological cover. He felt people needed to, normal people, not brave oppositional people, but ordinary soldiers, ordinary, should we say, conformist Germans, needed the kind of psychological excuse of telling themselves or playing a game with themselves where they could tell themselves that this was a German station. Which is very intricate, but everybody who worked on it writes about this. I mean, this is sort of something they all thought about a lot.
Is there a way, though, of trying to figure out what both what worked and what didn't work, but also whether it made any difference? I mean, in other words, you know, people fought in Berlin to the very end, and actually in the west of Germany, they surrendered to the British and Americans because they didn't want the Russians to get too far. So some people remained loyal either, you could say, to Hitler or to their country to the very end. I just wondered, the metric of this is very difficult, isn't it, to decide who was changed their mind or who was jolted into awareness, as you put it, by what they heard.
It's so hard, but frankly, it's always hard. I mean, measuring the impact of media is very hard because there's so many other influences acting on us. And Delmer always avoided questions about this. He always said, look, I was just there to sort of corrode faith in the Nazi system. And he tried to avoid that question. We do know that, like, from surveys from POWs, some 40% of Germans, soldiers were listening to it. We have the Nazis' own sort of internal communications, which are now, you know, largely public, about how alarmed they are by Delmer's media, that we have the head of the SS in Munich saying his stations are among the top three listened to in Munich in late 1943. And then we have soldiers saying that they defected because they heard something on the radio, which they did regularly. So you do have lots of inputs saying it was listened to, so an engagement metric. You have some metrics of effects. I mean, one of the big effects was the Valkyria Rebellion said they were partly inspired by Delmer's radio. So you have those sort of examples as well, a very kind of direct action. There's also, I mean, Delmer was interested in something that we today would call behavioral change rather than attitudinal change. So encouraging economic runs on stores, for example, getting people to go and buy up a certain product by saying it would soon be scarce. So the little effects like that you can measure as well. In terms of surrender, you're quite right. On the Eastern Front, they fought to the last man because they were actually rightly petrified of Soviet atrocities. In the West, both soldiers surrendered in droves, and then more spectacularly, you'd have cities surrendering, even when the local Nazi officials didn't want them to surrender. Part of it, the Russians come too far. Part of it, because they knew the Americans and the British were actually treating people well. Could Delmer's media have played a role? Could well have. I mean, there's some concrete cases that he quotes about the guy, the general, I think it's von Schlieben, surrendering Cherbourg in this very kind of slightly comedic scenario where the Americans surround it. And they're like, come out, you fought your last battle. And he's like, well, I can't come out because my orders are to fight to the last man. But if we, and I'm paraphrasing here, if you have that awful secret weapon that I've been hearing about on the radio, Delmer's radios, if you had that, I'd have to surrender because then I'd be like, you know, no one can fight the secret weapon. And the secret weapon was one of the times that Delmer was using, you know, strategic disinformation, like, you know, like claiming that the British and Americans had some secret magnesium bomb or something. And the Americans shoot an empty shell into the air. And the general, who knows the story is nonsense, goes, oh, I see you have a secret weapon, and surrenders the town. Now, I have to say, this story is in Delmer's memoirs and a couple of other memoirs. I have not found it confirmed in the PW archive. So I can't 100% say that this really happened. However, it gives a, you know, it's a really nice indicator of how Delmer saw the role of what he was doing. Again, it's about the propaganda legitimizing what people want to do anyway. They wanted to surrender. This was giving them the excuse. He was a big believer in this. He didn't think you should persuade people, or you can persuade people. You've got to basically activate the bits of them that deep down want to, in this case, betray the Nazis because they want to survive, because they're not as strong believers in the Nazi cause as you might think, because there's cracks in the Nazi propaganda. You've got to find that bit of people and engage with them. And a lot of the time it's about survival. But it's also virtually always about taking agency for yourself. So it's about saying, I'm going to make a decision rather than my bosses. So there's a lot of sort of stimulating people's self-confidence in taking back control for themselves.
I thought that was a brilliant explanation. And I also loved at the end, you talked about what propaganda is at its most malign, because it, as I'm quoting here, exploits the need to feel ordinary and impels a type of belonging where you give up the capacity to differentiate between good and bad. At its most extreme, it makes mass murder ordinary. I thought that was very moving and very, very perceptive, because then people just simply accept something which is obviously unacceptable, except they come to agree that it might be okay.
Yeah, and the reason I use the word ordinary is because Delmer plays with this word in his memoirs, and I'm trying to work out what he means by ordinary and extraordinary. And there's obviously kind of a sort of an echo there of Hannah Arendt's banality of evil, though I don't think it's quite the same thing. But Delmer was so good at understanding the seductions of propaganda because he was honest enough to admit that he was kind of vulnerable to it himself. Delmer was actually born in Berlin, spoke fluent German, even spoke with a German accent until his sort of his 20s, apparently. But as a British boy in Berlin, trapped there in the first years of the First World War, he was bullied for being British. He was very patriotic. And then there's this incredible scene that he describes, which I actually quote right at the start of my book, because I find it so indicative, where he's sort of in the, you know, during these kind of like marching exercises that were done by his school. We went to march around the hall and chant patriotic German war songs. And like every school kid, he has to do that as well. And despite him being a British boy and being bullied for being British, he starts to get into these German patriotic songs. And he's singing, before he knows it, he's there singing and blasting out these, like, you know, songs glorifying the German nation and the German soldier and German victory. And a bit of him is like, I'm actually enjoying this. I'm enjoying being the collective. I'm enjoying being part of the group. I'm enjoying letting myself go into the crowd. And because he was honest enough about that. I mean, he's a 10-year-old kid. I mean, can't blame him or anything. But because he was honest about that, and he describes it in very powerful detail, he could understand the seduction of wanting to blend in, of to be part of a crowd, which is part, of course, is what the Nazis exploited so, so strongly. But he also knew that even when you're being part of a crowd, even when you're in this sort of hysterical mob, you're always acting a little bit. And at his most sophisticated, Delmer is really fixated on this. What he wants to do is sort of unpeel the way even a relatively fervent Nazi follower is actually acting a little bit. Now, Delmer is definitely not a romantic. He's definitely, actually, one of the things he says is like, let the BBC preach democracy. He's not going to preach any democracy. His job is to win a war. He's not going to preach to anyone. He's going to give people the information and also give people the emotional release, because his radio stations were incredibly emotional. But they basically turned the anger back onto the Nazis. You know? They were like, they made them the guilty party in a soldier's misery or the death of your family members. And he talks about this. He wanted to cover the Nazis with a film of filth so vile as what they did to the Jews. So he was reverse engineering what they did in order to kind of like find another way for people to express their anger. And once that anger had been repressed, go like, well, don't you want to save yourselves now? You know? You've experienced your anger in a different way. So how about defecting?
Peter, let's return back to the modern era. What have you, and indeed should we, learn from Sefton Delmer and his work?
I mean, I find him incredibly relevant today. I mean, when we live in a world where, you know, the mob is back, and the mob is back online a lot of the time, a lot of the, you don't need you don't need a rally necessarily. You can create these kind of crowd scenes online, which is so, so interesting. But we're all very much acting. I mean, Delmer would have had a field day with social media and with Instagram, where people are constantly posing in a certain way and doing a selfie of themselves and, you know, play acting a certain political identity. He would have had a complete field day with that, saying, really, is that really you? Don't you have something else that you want? He's in many ways a character of the 19th century, even in many of his attitudes and stuff, but also a very contemporary one in his understanding of the performative aspect of propaganda.
One takeaway I had from the book is that we need to be even more, I was going to say suspicious, but at least we have to interrogate our sources of news and information for all the reasons that you have just suggested, which is, who's telling me this? Why are they telling me this? Do they have an agenda which is not obvious, but maybe there?
So look, we live in a world where we kind of talked ourselves into the idea that you can't break through polarization, that there's people over there in their bubble and we're over here in our bubble and we can't reach them. Delmer proved that you could reach people as long as you created content that was relevant to them and often relevant to their lives. I mean, a lot of the stories that he did were relevant to German soldiers' lives. I just think that tells you something really quite deep, that you know, you can break through the deepest partisanship and the deepest skepticism, as long as you can actually make yourself relevant to people. And people will understand your motivations. I mean, the German soldiers knew perfectly well the British were trying to win the war, but they were ready to listen and to engage because the content was so relevant and so powerful. So I think there's something quite inspirational there. If you need to, you can try to reach them. And in this case, the British needed to, because there was a war on.
Is there a way in which the kind of things that Delmer was doing and your analysis of it can be applied to what's happening now, particularly in Ukraine and Russia?
Basically, my lessons from the book, and the book is around 20% the present, 80% World War II, there are both negative and positive lessons. So Delmer's memoirs were called Black Boomerang, which was a reference to how his disinformation campaigns boomeranged on him. So in his creation of these sort of like sort of soldiers who are right wing, but kind of rebellious, this in his creation of this idea that they existed, he felt that helped Nazis come back into power after the war. So he felt that by creating this delusion that there is are good soldiers out there or anti-Nazi soldiers out there, was actually incredibly harmful. And he felt that he does something very, very poisonous. So there's negative lessons to learn. Also, like, you know, a lot of the radios that Delmer tried to do that were sort of just, that were deceptive about their sources, they were found out very quickly. I mean, now you'd find them out even quicker. It's actually, Delmer had much more success when he did these larger stations that, as I described, gave cover to people, but he wasn't trying to hide that he was British anymore. So that's a big lesson, I think, actually, trying to do sock puppet media. I mean, even now it's going to get caught in seconds. You know, Delmer could keep that going for a few months in the Second World War. But now, apart from the morality of it, the ethics of it, just the efficacy of it, you're not going to get away with it very long. Delmer's lesson is different. Delmer's lesson is not that part, which is sadly or frankly very standard in wartime. The Germans were doing tons of this sort of stuff to the British. Delmer's lesson is that if you get to know your audience well enough, if you create actually genuine stories that are relevant to them, you can motivate them in ways that will be, if we're talking about a war, that will be bad for their leaders. So right now, you know, Ukraine is clearly in an existential war fighting off Russia's invasion. We're helping them. I wish we were helping them a lot more, frankly, but we are helping them. Probably the Ukrainians should do it, but maybe there's something of our historical knowledge that we could help with. Yeah, I think tomorrow Russian soldiers should wake up with a media that is probably a multimedia, not just radio these days, but radio is still very useful, actually, that would be giving them all the latest stories about the corruption, not of Putin, that's too easy, of the guy next door just above them who's not giving them the proper rations because he's selling them off down the road. And all these kind of stories that are really viscerally important to their lives about the quality of food, about why their wives aren't getting paid the money that they were promised when they were coming to serve. All these stories about the reality of war on the front. I think that would be just sort of stuff that you need to do in a war. But it takes to do well, to do the information gathering, to really know about people's lives, about the lives, the personal lives of their commanding officers, about what it's really like on the front, actually takes a huge amount of effort. I mean, I'd say the vast majority of Delmer's work was gathering the information from partisan groups, from POWs, from correspondence of German officials with family abroad. He had this incredible research team, and that was really where the hard work was. It's the information gathering and the research. So it's not easy to do that. To do it badly is easier than ever, you know? But to actually do it with the level of research that it makes people go, oh my God, these people know everything about our lives and understand our conditions better than our own bosses, that takes real guile and real effort.
Peter, thank you. And Peter Pomerantsev's new book is called How to Win an Information War. Once again, thanks to our Patreon supporters for helping keep our show on the road. If you'd like to help us bring you the best interviews and insights on the most pressing problems we face today, plus get the show early and ad-free and gain access to our merchandise, then you can sign up to support for as little as £3 a month by searching Patreon. This is not a drill. I'm Gavin Essler. Thank you for listening.
This is Not a Drill. It was written and presented by Gavin Essler and produced by Robin Lieber. Our music was by Paul Hartnell and art by Jim Parrott. Group editor is Andrew Harrison, executive producer Martin Boytosh, and This is Not a Drill. It is a Podmasters production.